I'm going to begin this morning and continue for the next 2 weeks talking to you about death and dying and the afterlife. And this is a series that I've done every year for a number of years now. And this year I will be including some work by Peter Kreeft, a Dutch philosopher, a book that is called Love is Stronger Than Death. And this is quite an exceptional book, and I'll be referring to it from time to time throughout this series. And the thing that I want to begin with today is to, first of all, talk about death as something that is more personal than anything else I know of. That I have a terminal illness, and so do you. And it is a kind of illness, though, that for reasons that I hope we discover in the course of these lectures, doesn't appear in consciousness very often. We don't deal with it. We don't often make the decisions about life that one should purportedly make if one recognized that one had this terminal illness. And because of that, it seems advisable to me to bring this material to your consciousness. At least each year during the Lenten time, as a time of ritual consciousness about death and dying, because what the Lenten season is about for Christian people is about the death and dying of Jesus Christ. It's also about the meaning of death and dying, though, because Jesus Christ came to reveal something to us about the nature of death and dying that hitherto was unknown. Now, that's quite a claim. And one of the things that I will be moving toward with you is trying to establish for you what is it that was hitherto unknown that Jesus Christ came to reveal about death and dying that you will not find in Stoicism, you will not find in Eastern religions, you will not find in Judaism, you will not find this in Mohammedanism, you will not find this in existentialism. That it's something quite unique to the Christian message. And the question that we ask ourselves at the beginning of the Lenten season is, why death? Why death? I don't mean that just as an existential question, but I mean when you look at the death of Christ, if Christ was the Son of God and mankind was in need of redemption, whatever that means now, because it's always been hard for me to fully understand that, how existentially I was personally in need of redemption. The older I get, the easier it is to understand that, I would tell you. But that question is difficult. And somehow God came, God sent His Son, according to the Christian message, to redeem us, to bring this atonement, this at-one-ment, some kind of unification of the division that had been caused by sin. And that somehow in the Christian message, and this is probably the most important sentence, that the wages of sin, whatever that sin was, the wages of sin is death. Now there is an implication in that, that if there had not been sin, there would not have been death. That is radical. That's a radical message, that if there had not been sin, there would not have been death. And, that's a powerful implication, and I want to probe that with you. Now, probably the most common position on death and dying, we have this terminal illness, we're all going to die, it's completely predictable, it's completely expected, it's the only absolute we know for sure. The one thing you know for sure that you have to do is die. Okay? So the most common response to that when people think about it and probe it is the Stoic position. And Stoicism has always been an alternative to Christianity. When Freud wrote The Future of an Illusion, he recapitulated a modern Stoic position. He took a whack at Christianity, and I think he needed to. I think it was a good whack. That needed to be done, but his solution to the problem of death and dying, the answer that he gave was Stoicism. And Stoicism really says there are two gods, Anakē and Logos. Anakē is necessity and Logos is reason. These are my two gods, Freud said. Reason and necessity. And in essence, what he said was that this is what you have to build your religion on. And in a Stoic dispensation, then, death is just a natural event. And what you have to do is just accept death as part of reality. There is death, there is birth, copulation, and death. Those are the three biggies. And you just accept that and bow your head and say amen. Now, there's something inhuman about that, especially not about birth and copulation, but about death. There's something quite inhuman about that. Just to bow your head and say amen to that. Oh, Dad died. Mm-hmm. I knew that was coming. We don't do it that way. That is not the way we respond to death. As a matter of fact, one of the most astonishing things is that we always respond to death in a shocked manner. Interestingly enough, we respond to time the same way too, the passage of time. And death and time are quite related. Folks, there's lots of seats up here if you want to come over here. And there's some seats up front here. Death and time are quite related. We say of someone who is, I can't believe how time flies, we say. Or I can't believe it's already February the whatever. And you say this more as you grow older because time seems to go faster as you grow older, which is a very interesting thing, that there seems to be some relationship to aging and the swiftness of time. Now, I don't know what it is, but there is that phenomena. To a child, the time between two summers is like an eternity, whereas to an adult, it's already May again. So there is that factor, but time and death and aging, I can't believe Rothgar is already 13 or 14. My gosh, that kid's already grown up. I can't believe it. And these that you see, what we say in our common parlance is phenomenologically important. We also have a phenomena that interests me greatly in our culture, which is to kill time. We have great effort to kill time. The guy, Mickey Spillane, and who's the woman that wrote all the detective stories? Agatha Christie. I forget the numbers of millions of detective stories. It's like 89 million for Agatha Christie and 59 million for Mickey Spillane. There's no novelist, there's no piece of literature in all of our writings, in all of American literature, that even approximates the number of detective stories that have been written and bought and purchased and read. Because detective stories embody the exact quality of mythology. There is no time, really, in a detective story. And in the detective story, good triumphs over evil. Maybe in a shaggy manner, but good triumphs over evil. Ultimately, the good triumphs over evil. And so as you read this, you read the cosmic, psychic, collective unconscious drama, or you read the collective conscious of the human race, the desire to kill time and to be into a world of 007 that is magical and mystical and all of that. So there's a phenomena that we look at in us as a people that's very, very interesting. We cannot get rid of mythology. We are inextricably mythical because mythology has to do with the conquest of time. Our poets, our philosophers tell us that what they're doing in their works of art is attempting to bypass time in some way, to get beyond time. In the preface to one of his novels, Joseph Conrad says that what I am trying to do in my writing is to catch, in a moment of courage, a passing phase of life and to snatch it from the remorseless rush of time. The remorseless rush of time to snatch in a moment of courage a passing phase of life from the remorseless rush of time. That's what I'm trying to do in my novels. I'm trying to create a little knothole into the ballpark of eternity. He didn't say that. But that's my own stuff. A little glimpse into the ballpark of eternity. That somehow he can do that with the written novel or with the poem. That we can stop time. Stop time from its remorseless rush. In the Rubaiyat, the poet says, "The moving finger writes, and having writ, moves on. Nor all thy piety nor wit can lure it back to cancel half a line. Nor all thy tears wash out a word of it." Time's gone. It's over with. Tears, idle tears, I know not what they mean. Tears that rise from the depth of some divine despair, rise in the heart and gather to the eyes, and looking on the sunny autumn fields and thinking of the days that are no more. The romantic tendency is sort of a bondage to the past. And a longing for the golden days. All of you adept at English literature and literature know the romantic periods are the periods where you go back to the great time, the golden time. And you have the romantic illnesses in neurotic, too, in neurosis. Person who keeps trying to go back and live their life over again, who won't accept where their life is now. See, all of these are sort of attitudes toward time, but ultimately they're all attitudes toward death. They're ultimately attitudes toward death. Now, another major attitude toward death in our own time came after the Second World War. Became very popular after the Second World War and was embodied mostly by a very brilliant, honest, courageous Frenchman named Albert Camus. And Albert Camus, living in the time of the German occupation of France, in the Blitzkrieg lightning wars, and the terrors of the Second World War, and ultimately in the terrors of Dachau and Auschwitz, Camus wrote a book called The Myth of Sisyphus. And in that book, he proposed that there is only one truly philosophical question. That all philosophy and all theology boil down to this question. And the question is whether you should live or die. That is the question of suicide. He asked, if life has a meaning, if life has no meaning, then why should you live? Why should you live? And he felt that life was very much like the myth of Sisyphus described. That Sisyphus was the man who rolled this mighty rock up a hill. And when he got to the top of the hill, he stood and flexed his muscles and breathed deeply, and then the wind came up and blew it down the other side. And totally stoic in his endurance, so there's some stoicism in this one too, Sisyphus walked down the hill, pushed the rock back up, knowing that very soon the wind would come up again, from the other side and blow it down the other side. But he kept pushing the rock up the hill no matter what. Now, there is a lot that's comparable to our own lives in that myth. You get up in the morning, you go to work, and I don't care whether you're the boss or not. You go to work, you have your coffee break, you have your lunch, you go back to work, you get home, you take off your shoes, you put on your slippers, you watch television. You go to sleep, you get up in the morning, you go to work, you take coffee break, and there's a certain sense of, and then you look forward to your 3-week vacation or 2-week vacation or whatever. But in the final analysis, and you get a peptic ulcer in the process, and you're trying to love some people, and you're trying to pack up a little money for your old age, and you retire and you die. And I literally watched my own father do that. I watched him work all his life. to his retirement. I remember the glee and the joy of his retirement. No sooner had he retired, it was within weeks, literally, that he began to develop the bad emphysema. Of course, he smoked right to the very end, developed that emphysema, and he, you know, within 6 months couldn't take a step without losing his breath, had to be on oxygen. Within a year and a half, he was laying downtown at a hospital with a tracheotomy, dying with a machine breathing for him. Now, in the face of that, and I look at the wholeness of his life, it is easy at one level to go, man, this is absurd. And so what the existentialists in essence say, that it is absurd, or Albert Camus or Hemingway, Farewell to Arms, where you have Frederick Henry walking, as always raining in Hemingway's novels. Frederick Henry walking out into the rain, which is, see, this sort of morbid frame of life. And Frederick Henry is walking out into the rain, and he's experiencing this sadness over Catherine's death. Here was this romance that we had watched a form in this novel, and it had grown, and it had flourished, and it had dipped, and it had gone through all the stages, and it was at its apex, and then Catherine started dying. Catherine got pneumonia and died. And as he walks out into the rain and he thinks about it, he's looking down and he just says, it's just a damn dirty trick. And it sort of flashes back to this other metaphor in the novel of the ants on the burning log, where he's in the war and he's sitting there with a cup of water getting ready to have a drink, and he could have thrown the cup of water on the burning log and saved the ants. And he has this moment where he could be their savior. And then he says, well, what's the use? They're just going to burn on another log sometime soon. So he just throws the water away and gets himself a hit of whiskey. And pretty much that's Hemingway's philosophy. That is the philosophy of the theater of the absurd metaphysics, of the angst existential metaphysics. And Camus was very courageous in it. He said, no, I'm going to take this question through to its end, and I'm willing to kill myself if I can't find a meaning. Now, Camus felt that he had found a meaning, that somehow he wrote a novel called The Plague, where everyone was dying of this plague. And there was a doctor in the novel, there was a priest in the novel, there was a businessman in the novel, there was every walk of life represented in the novel. Now, of course, the plague was the symbol in this novel of the plague that we are all in, that we are all dying. We are all dying. We all have a terminal illness. We're all sitting here, and every one of us is destined to die of this illness called death. And so how we respond to that. And the doctor, the priest talked about the afterlife, and the doctor didn't believe in the afterlife. But what you got from the doctor, who I think is more who Camus identified with, is that he was going to fight this thing to the death. And it was in the rebellion against it. It was in the rebellion against it that life had a meaning. And so he wrote The Rebel and the Metaphysics of the Rebellion, or The Metaphysics of the Rebel. And he said, I rebel, therefore we are. It's in the rebellion that life has a meaning. That we all come together, we join together, fighting this common enemy, which is our death. And we fight it with science, we fight it by prolonging life, by improving our technology and our medicine, and we just fight it to the bitter end. And that's what gives life meaning. Now, those two positions, Stoicism and existentialism, I believe are possibly the more common responses to death, really. I believe the Christian response is very limited in its true response among at least people that I see and talk to and listen to, and I would have to say, including myself, for about 44 years, that I simply had mostly those responses, although I gave lip service to the others. I think the Christian response is a much more exciting one, frankly. But it's not like a child that I've come to believe it. It's like through the crucible of doubt. And I certainly taught existentialism at the University of St. Thomas, And I remember when I left the seminary, a priest who was going to teach the course that I had set up, he wrote me one of the most profound letters I've ever gotten. He said, "I understand the state of your soul by looking at this course you've set up." I was to teach a course in existentialist philosophy, and I was also to teach a course in English literature, and the books that I had chosen, Faulkner's The Sound and the Fury, Life is a Tale Told by an Idiot, Full of Sound and Fury, Signifying Nothing, from Shakespeare. That was one of the pieces I was using. I was using Farewell to Arms as another piece. I was using a German whose family had been killed in the war, and I had a number of his stories. And I was in this place, so that when I left that Catholic seminary, that is the position I was in. And I just want to share that with you, because I don't want you to think that I'm up here trying to give you some kind of party line. I used to object to that outrageously when I thought someone was trying to give me the party line. That is, mouth to me some Christian doctrine that they themselves had never gone through the pain and the crucifixion of coming to believe. And what I'm interested in is people who have come to believe it through the struggle. I'm not interested in people who learned it, got hypnotized in it, mouth it now without any thought. That bothers me greatly, and I'm sure it's okay for them. I'm not putting them down for it. But it strikes me that it's more important that I have a faith now that is much more conditioned by it fits my life experience to a high, high degree. You see, because the first thing I want to tell you is that Stoicism to me is inhuman. For someone to tell me that my father died and it had to be, that there needed to be a level of being in the universe. Here's reason. Here's the way Leibniz, the rationalist philosopher, would argue that. He would say, look, there's quite a variety in being. There needs to be a level of being that cannot fail, and there needs to be a level of being that can fail in order to have a balanced level of being. Your father was on the level of being that could fail, and that's why he died. Now, you think that would give you any solace? See, that's the rationalist answer. And, oh, God, I can go read Leibniz and give you all these brilliant rational arguments for why we have to die. But that doesn't, if your baby died, if your child died, or the people that I have counseled with who are in the most pain over this, or the parents whose children have died, or a child has committed suicide, or a child has been murdered. And I don't know whether any of you know anybody, but there's a group now of children who've been murdered, parents of children who've been murdered. There's a group now of parents whose children have committed suicide. I mean, these are some of the toughest things that anyone will ever have to deal with in their whole life. And I'm not sure that the murder of a child or the suicide of a child may not rank as the top ones in terms of a person working through the grief. Certainly the loss of a child, I've been through that with three couples now, is something that's beyond my comprehension of what they really have to deal with, the grieving out of that. And the grieving takes a year and a half to 2 years, a rough estimate. So you see, we're not talking about something that can be glibly dismissed with that it's natural. Yeah, well, we knew Shirley had to die anyway someday, so she just got it sooner than later. I mean, that kind of talk doesn't work. And when you're talking to people who are dealing with someone dying or dead, someone who has died, all the logic you can give them just won't work. And I want to suggest that to you very powerfully, that you don't go and try to give people reasons why somebody died. That you go and put your arms around them, and you love them, and you just be there for them. And just let them know that you're there for them. And that you're there just to be with them no matter what, and that you flat don't understand, because you don't. If you haven't lost a child yourself, you don't understand. And if you haven't experienced the death of a loved one yet, you don't understand. and especially the death of a parent. Because the death of a parent will affect your life in a way that nothing has ever affected it. Even if you don't have a very good relationship with them, it will affect your life in a way that nothing has ever affected you. Abe Maslow said that all the books you will ever read will not be comparable to the death of one of your parents, going through the death of one of your parents. Because you grow up at that moment in a way that you cannot nor have ever grown up. And life takes on a soberness at that moment in a way that it has never taken on before. So there's a sobering moment that comes with the death of a loved one. So to say that death is natural somehow doesn't work for us. And I think that's a key. That's a very important thing. It's not that we don't say it. We do say it. Someone dies, we say that's life. That acknowledges a certain understanding and acceptance of it. Or put it another way, we understand that things are dying all the time so that things can live. That I'm here because a whole bunch of cows died. The steaks I've eaten, the food I've eaten along the way, have to do with animals being slaughtered. You ever been to a slaughterhouse? And, you know, the people that get all upset with me about fish that are sitting there eating steaks, I throw them back if I don't eat them. But there's this thing about killing things. Well, we're killing things all the time. And things are dying all the time in order that other things may live. So it's obvious if you look around that the cycles of birth and death are natural cycles. Everything seems natural till you come to your own death or the death of somebody you love. Now, Camus is wrong. He's flat wrong. We don't need some big philosophical treatise to tell us to rebel. We already do it. I didn't need to read the Myth of Sisyphus and the Metaphysics of the Rebel to say I rebel, therefore we are. I was already doing it. And so were you. Everybody who's fighting for their life is rebelling against dying. All the longevity studies, all the interest in long life are forms of rebellion against dying. It's not true that we need to have a philosophy that tells us to rebel. We already do it. So in my opinion, Stoicism is not adequate, nor is existentialism adequate, although there's important truths in both of them. There's an important thing for us to look at in both of them. The thing that I think we have to come to, at least for me to come to, is that the meaning of death is the meaning of life. And if death has no meaning, which is what Camus is saying, then I don't think life can have a meaning. And you can't say that if something is meaningless in the long run, but meaningful in the short run, that that's okay. Not in the case of death, because the meaning of the short run is the long run. Please, that this is a philosophical question. That's a position that I have always taken. That the meaning of death is not a psychological, not a medical, not a sociological, not a cultural question, that the ultimate meaning of this question is philosophico-theological. That it's the oldest question we have. In the Epic of Gilgamesh, which antedates Homer by 1,500 years, this is the question. Gilgamesh cannot understand why his friend Enkidu has died. And he searches for the meaning of immortality. In those old Babylonian tablets, we have the story of Utnapishtim, who is the man who survived the flood. And we know that these tablets were brought to the Fertile Crescent when Abraham migrated. We know that he knew the stories of the flood. He knew the stories about Utnapishtim. The Noah story was a model of the story of Utnapishtim. And that Utnapishtim had built an ark and had survived death. He had the secret of immortality. And Gilgamesh seeks the secret of immortality and never can quite get it. But it's fascinating to me that this oldest piece of literature is dealing with the question of what is the meaning of death. Why? Because that question has to do with the meaning of life. If death is just a damn dirty trick, That's what Hemingway says. Then life is a damn dirty trick. To get a peptic ulcer just to die, or Crohn's colitis, or to go through all this agony and suffering just to be snuffed out, to go through the eight ages. If you're following the eight ages, every age leads you to greater freedom, more fuller understanding. We don't get to love till we get to the sixth age. We don't get to caring till we get to the seventh age. We don't get to wisdom till we get to the eighth age. And then we die. So get wise and die. You see, there's some ways in which it's obvious to look at this as absurd. If there is no meaning to that death, which we will all go through, then there's something absurd about it. There's something absurd about it, and maybe the question of suicide is a legitimate question. See, lots of people are committing suicide all the time. I see them around me daily, and I believe that this is the question that they've decided on hopelessly, that they drive cars at racing speeds, they eat themselves to death, smoke themselves to death, drink themselves to death, don't care about themselves, that deep down this question has not been dealt with. It's avoided, or it's been decided on the negative side. Because once you decide that life has meaning, that death has meaning, then living life to the full becomes crucial. It becomes important, and that's why I'm doing this series. Not to decide whether death is stoic or existentialist or Christian, but so that you personally can come out of it living your life with more meaning. And I'm going to submit to you that if you don't understand something of this question, you can't live your life more meaningfully. This is the ultimate question. There is no question that supersedes this question. But because this question is also going to bring to us the meaning of God. See, if life has a meaning and death has a meaning, then somehow those meanings are going to be related to God. And we've got to bring everything comes in with this question. It's also interesting to me that the earliest funeral religious rites are funeral rites. The earliest remnants we have of any kind of religious ceremony is a funeral rite. The earliest philosophers understood that all of philosophy, Cicero said, is a commentatio mortis, is a commentary on death. All of philosophy is a commentary on death. So what we're always talking about is being and non-being. Now, here's the interesting thing that comes up when we look at death, and we try to answer it either as natural, as absurd, that we rebel and therefore we are, that somehow, even though we know all of these things, we know that death is natural, we rebel, therefore it is, we know we never step into the same river twice, there is something about it that still shocks us. That still shocks us. And it would seem that if we really had accepted this, that we would not be so shocked. No matter what we do, there's a shock about it. This is what Peter Kreeft writes. We are shocked at the irreversibility of death. Although it is utterly familiar, it is utterly universal, and it is utterly natural. We find the natural to be unnatural. Let us be shocked at our shock, he says. Why are we shocked? When it happens around us daily, it is as natural as the air we breathe. Read the paper every morning, and yet we are shocked. The first reaction to the death of someone you know is, no, you're kidding. Not Tom, Mary, Jane, Betty. No, oh, you've got to be. I can't believe that. I can't believe that, we say. So the first reaction is denial. Let us be shocked at our shock. It is shocking that we are shocked at the inevitable, the familiar, the expected. This is our natural state, and yet is the state most contrary to our inclination. This is our natural state. From dust we come, to dust we'll return. And yet we're outraged by it. Death is natural. We find it unnatural. Let's look at both halves of the puzzle, he writes. First, death naturalness. Death is essential to nature. It is death that allows everything in nature to live. We live by eating dead animals and plants. Animals live by eating dead plants. New people, animals, and plants come to life to replace the old ones that died. Death is the fertilizer of life. We know this. We say, so-and-so died. Oh, yes, that's life. And yet we rebel. Death is as natural as the world, but we rebel against the world. We have a lover's quarrel with the world. And so here he quotes somebody. I don't know who this is. If you're really a product of a material universe, how is it that you don't feel at home there? Do fish complain of the sea for being wet? Or if they did, would that fact itself not strongly suggest that they had not always been or would not always be purely aquatic creatures? Notice how we are perpetually surprised at time. How time flies. Fancy that. Fancy John being grown up and married. I can hardly believe it. In heaven's name, why? And this is what he concludes. Unless there is something in us which is not temporal. See, if nothing in nature is absolute, we don't know of anything in nature which is absolute, yet to us death is absolute, maybe death is unnatural. Maybe there is something about us which is non-temporal, because we are so shocked by the temporal. Now we enter the Christian sphere, because this is exactly what the Christian teaching is saying. That the wages of sin is death, that the natural state of man is not to die. Now that is outrageous in itself, in terms of our common thought patterns. But if you go read the book of Genesis, the condition of paradise was that they would be impassible, they would not be sick. Remember 2 years ago when I did the healing in the body-mind? I showed you and listened to Rolling Thunder. Listen to Rolling Thunder tell you that those medicine men have known for hundreds of years that you don't have to be sick. You don't have to be sick. That we know how. We know how to control sickness and evil. Black Elk, the great Indian chief, when he died, he just walked up on a hill and died, like Jesus. He walked up there and said, "It is consummated," and died, implying that he had some power over his own death. Now, if you read the accounts of Jesus come this Good Friday, you read those accounts carefully, you will see in every biblical account we have that Jesus said, "It is consummated, it is finished," that he proclaimed his own death, implying that he had some decision over it. Some decision over it. And Jesus, as the new Adam, the firstborn of the new age, was bringing back to us the possibilities of paradise. The possibilities of the psi phenomena, psychokinesis, clairvoyance, telepathy, all the miracles that so-called miracles that he displayed, we now know are possibilities of higher consciousness. And so as we enter into this new age, there's the possibility of truly understanding that death can be overcome. The wages of sin is death. Now that's the Christian message. Now, the reason God chose death as the vehicle for the Christ is something I'll be looking to as we go along. But there is something profoundly significant about that. It wasn't just accidental that of all the choices that could have been made, God decided in His divine plan that He would use death as the vehicle of redemption. That there's something about that we must understand. What is there in the nature of death as death? What is there in the nature of death as death which made it the proper vehicle for divine redemption? That is a profound question, seldom been asked, and I really want you to ponder it. Why death? Because God could have done it lots of other ways. Could have done it lots of other ways than had His Son die. Yet there's something profound about death that makes it the proper vehicle for the atonement, for the at-one-ment, for bringing the whole world back together again. Now, that's what I want to look at. I want to look at this unnaturalness of the natural. Kleeft writes, one of the things about death is that it shocks us because it doesn't seem to be natural. If nothing in nature is absolute and death is absolute, then death is not in nature. It's not natural. Perhaps that is why it shocks us. It appears to be part of nature's changing cycle, and yet our own death is absolute. It removes our whole world. When your friend dies, you lose a friend. When you die, you lose all your friends. It's not relative. It's absolute. For me, it's absolute. And that's why even with the death of a loved one, as powerful and as profound as that can be, there's always a sigh of, whew. You know, I was incensed the other day when Nancy told me that she hoped I died before she did. And yet, if I think about it, so do I. Not hope that I die before she did. You see, that there's deep down that you can love somebody, but there's still one little element that says, you know, I hope I live, I keep living. And even when someone you loved has died, there's still a sense of, whew, there's still a slight sense of that. Although the grieving is often, you don't want to live either, or you feel like you don't. But you see, this absoluteness of my own personal death appears as exceptional. In science, it is always the apparent exception that is the important phenomena, because it is the clue to the deeper meaning. So what Cleef wants to do is say, let's look at this phenomena of our outrage, best expressed by Dylan Thomas. Rage, rage, rage against the night, he says. Or by the guy who wrote The Denial of Death, where he talks about you get butchered in the end, and I'm going to fight that. Or it's Camus, fight it. But what is this phenomena where death is obviously natural, but we refuse to accept it as natural? We're outraged by it as natural. And he says, let's explore this apparent exceptionality about death. At first, although we never win, we fight it. Although death is inevitable and irreversible, we still rebel. Camus didn't have to tell us to do that. Second, our own death is the only absolute, it seems, in a world of relativities, the only absolutely final event in a world of cycles, the only natural phenomena that doesn't seem to be natural. And the third puzzle is darker still. It's the darkest and deepest of all. This puzzle is that death seems to have something to do with guilt. Our myths, our dreams, psychoanalysis, hundreds of cases of psychoanalysis reveal to us a deep feeling of guilt about death. And what could that possibly mean? So these are the kinds of leads that we're going to take now in exploring this phenomena. I have also found the phenomena of guilt related to the phenomena of death. It's obvious to us in grieving that guilt is related to death. It's not obvious to us when we come to our own death that there's a quality of guilt related to death. And it may be that what we're dealing with there is the deepest kind of wound, that when we go back to that doctrine of original sin, although I wouldn't accept it in its mythical form as it's been handed down, there is something profound about it that causes us to stop and think. And you see, the thing that I've done with you over the last years is to look at, because of this phenomena, because of this ambiguity and confusion, what we do is we deny death. The most common response, other than stoicism or existentialism, is denial. We either deny it altogether, and you can do that if you're Christian Science, you can say you don't really die. If you're Christian, you have to be careful. If you've been given an answer too soon, if you got the answer too soon, you have to be careful. When you were a little kid, that you said, where did Grandma go? And everybody said unequivocally, she went to heaven. There's nothing ever to worry about. And they rocked you in the night and said, you don't ever have to worry. There is a sense in which you can cop out with your own Christian doctrine or your own religious doctrine. You can cop out by not dealing with it existentially. Now, I'm not saying that you can't arrive at the same position, but dealing with it existentially is what's important. You can deny the fact of it, or you can have what is more common in our society, the pornography of death, where we hide it as being personal. We watch television every night, and we see war stories and detective stories and hospital stories. Think of all the modern entertainment that has to do with policemen, detectives, war stories, hospital stories, And in every one of those stories, 20 people die or 10 people die in every episode. And you sit there watching people die every night and never once think, I am going to die. That is pornography. What pornography is to depersonalize. Pornography is pages of genitals without any people there. Right? Pornography got no people in there. There's nothing but genitals. So pornography is the depersonalizing of life. And when you depersonalize death, you talk about it in the abstract, but you don't talk about it in the concrete. So we have this massive conspiracy in modern life to keep us from looking at that. So we can just deal with it every single night and never once have to say, I'm going to die. Or you can drive down here on any given day and never think of the numbers of people that are dying up there, or how many of you would, you know, stroll through an intensive care unit just, you know, to take a look and realize that, you know, this is where we're all headed. If we're lucky, we get there. And so anyway, there's a tremendous kind of denial, and then that clothes our fears of death. And as we don't deal with our fear of the process of dying or the fate of the body or separation from loved ones, all the kind of fears I've talked to you about over the years, then we don't look at our fears of living, because life and death go together. The meaning of death and the meaning of life are going to go together. What I'm ultimately going to show you is that whatever position you take on life, that's going to be the position you take on death. If your fear of dying is the fear of pain, I bet you have all kind of fears of pain in living. You don't take risks. You don't take chances. You avoid doing a lot of things because you're so afraid of pain. You don't deal with relationships in the way they need to be dealt with. You don't confront. You don't show your anger because you're afraid of pain and discomfort. So that the very fears of death will also focus as your fears of life. And by not understanding death and where you actually are. See, finally, it doesn't matter what Christianity said or what John Bradshaw said or what anyone else said. It's what your own philosophy of death is. And you have one. The way you live your life is based on your own idiosyncratic personal philosophy about death. And in the deepest recesses of your being, that's what you're about. Because you cannot live knowing as you do that that gulf is awaiting you, that end is there, that equalizer that makes all of us the same. No matter how much money you've got, how much prestige you've got, that we return to the same place and you do it alone. There is no one there to take you over or take you through the end. You do it alone. Whatever your own personal philosophy is, that's what you want to discover in the next 5 weeks, because that is crucial to your living life while you've got it. See, I do not fear that I will die. I fear that I may have never begun to live. And if your fears of death are so denied, you can be truncating your life terribly out of unconscious fears of death. So that's the whole reason. I want to stimulate you. I want to open your consciousness to this question. I want to open your consciousness to your own premises with your own unconscious beliefs. You see, your premises are what you unconsciously believe. I just got in touch with a premise in my own life the other day. It's the premise of scarcity. Scarcity about money. I grew up in a world that was money was not available, so I was hypnotized into believing that money is scarce. I drive myself in my work unconsciously believing that money is scarce. That simply is not true. That's an unconscious belief that has driven me for 47 years. And it's one that's really worth getting rid of, because it's a driver, it's the basis of a good bit of my compulsivity. And you see, it's a premise that's never been examined. Likewise, your position on death is often a premise that's never been examined consciously. And your whole life is geared, the quality of your life comes out of that philosophy of death. So that's what we'll be exploring for the next few weeks.